Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. The Price of Power: How Mitch McConnell Mastered the Senate, Changed America, and Lost His Party, by Michael Tackett. This book was reviewed by Jennifer Zalai. For months after the January 6, 2021 rampage at the Capitol, the damaged window of Mitch McConnell's office was left unrepaired, a graphic reminder of the moment when one of the rioters bashed the fortified glass with a flagpole. McConnell, the Kentucky Republican, who was a Senate majority leader at the time, professed his disgust at what happened, calling it further evidence of Donald Trump's complete unfitness for office. According to The Price of Power, a new biography by Michael Tackett, McConnell already despised Trump, calling him not very smart, irascible, nasty, and a despicable human being. But a month later, when presented with the opportunity to convict Trump at his second impeachment trial for what McConnell declared to be as close to an impeachable offense as you can imagine, he refused to take it. A conviction could have disqualified Trump from holding office again. But McConnell wasn't ready to cast Trump into the political wilderness, at least not yet. Nearly 4 years on, he still isn't ready. McConnell says he will support Trump, who he deems a sleazeball, in the 2024 election. As Tackett puts it, he had no choice but to support the nominee. No choice. The phrase implies an unwavering sense of duty and commitment, when in fact it is more useful in revealing what McConnell's actual priorities are. He seems to have decided that Trump is reprehensible, wholly unfit for office, and even a menace to the Republic. "I just hope that he'll have to pay a price for it," he told Tackett, referring to Trump's efforts to try to overturn the 2020 election. Such contortions are so common they have become a cliché. The establishment Republican who complains bitterly about Trump in private while supporting him anyway. McConnell, though, dials this dissonance up to 11. Fancying himself one of the shrewdest power brokers in politics, he nevertheless emerges from Tackett's biography as someone who's both pathetic and willfully perverse, wistfully calling for Trump's comeuppance while doing everything in his power to thwart it. The Price of Power promises an intimate personal view of a politician who is famously controlling and tight-lipped. Since 2019, Tackett has been the Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Associated Press. Previously, he was a reporter for The Times. We do not know each other. McConnell sat down for more than 50 hours of interviews and granted Tackett access to his oral history project. A presumable factor in McConnell's willingness to cooperate with this book is his decision to step down as Senate Republican leader at the end of this year, though he says that he plans to serve out his current Senate term, which ends in January 2027. As for his health, McConnell tells Tackett that episodes in which he froze mid-sentence while speaking to reporters were the lingering effects of a concussion. Like any dutiful biographer, Tackett wants to show that McConnell is more complex than the power-hungry operator his critics make him out to be. But there's little here that counters what one unnamed Democratic senator says about McConnell, quoted in the book's opening pages. "I think he's a terribly cynical human being." Tackett tries mightily to make the most of his access. The first few chapters offer an inordinately granular account of McConnell's early years in Alabama, and then Georgia, and then finally Kentucky. McConnell was an only child of doting middle-class parents. He contracted polio at 2, an experience that Tackett says fueled McConnell's high achiever intensity as well as his sensitivity to criticism. Sometimes Tackett seems too much enthralled to the material, quoting at length from family papers, even at their most banal. He devotes half a chapter to letters exchanged between McConnell's parents before they married. I want you here with me. I'm simply dying to see you. I love you more than anything in the world. McConnell's high school assignments offer a glimpse into the coming of age of an aspiring Pole. He learned how to assemble a bland platitude. When I die, I want to be able to say to myself, I made contribution to this old world and try to make it a better place to live in. And when the inspiration didn't come, he figured out what to do in a pinch. Tackett quotes a 12th grade essay by McConnell that tracks in many respects word for word, a windy way of saying it plagiarizes, a 1904 poem by Bessie Anderson Stanley. Tackett's storytelling gets more confident once his subject arrives in Washington, but I can understand why he would try to wring as much material from McConnell's early years as he could. A figure like McConnell, guarded, determined, flatly uncharismatic, invites the curious biographer to search for a rosebud. But McConnell himself has always expressed a frank preoccupation with power and money. As Alec McGillis noted in The Cynic, 2014, his short but incisive biography of McConnell, raising and controlling boatloads of cash, became the means by which an ambitious politician could make up for his underwhelming persona. Such basic motivations would seem to be the most economical explanation for everything else. McConnell's crusade against campaign finance reform, his obstructionist strategy against Barack Obama, his rank refusal to give one-time Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland even a hearing, his determination to ram through the confirmation of Justice Amy Coney Barrett. An assiduous Tackett tries to find instances of McConnell using his power nobly. In 2016, McConnell requested that legislation to spur biomedical research be renamed in honor of Joe Biden's deceased son, Beau. Joe Biden considered it an act of personal decency. Tackett writes, McConnell had nothing to gain from doing so. True, but McConnell had nothing to lose either. Such an obvious gimme could only seem notable in an age of extreme political disaffection. Disaffection that McConnell, with his wily maneuvering and his willingness to grind government to a halt when it suits his team, has arguably done plenty to stoke. Tackett may have obtained considerable access in the sense of getting lots of interviews with McConnell. He diligently catches McConnell's many inconsistencies and relentless expediency. But the analysis is woefully thin. Reading The Price of Power, you also wouldn't know anything about McConnell's three daughters, other than the fact that he had them with his first wife. Not a word about the youngest, Porter, who became a progressive activist trying to halt the flood of money into politics that her own father worked so hard to unleash. Tackett ends the book with a scene at the 2024 Republican National Convention, when McConnell took the stage and was roundly booed. McConnell would come across as a more pitiable figure if the book had actually revealed a core self, one that was committed to an ideal, or at least a glimmer of one. An epilogue makes much of his support for Ukraine, but McConnell's hawkishness on foreign policy comes across as a gambit, too. It's not as if he credibly expresses sincere hopes for a world that's more peaceful and just. He simply prefers to talk about the threats posed by authoritarians abroad instead of dealing with the glaring problems at home. The overall sense you get from this biography is that McConnell has prioritized little besides his own political survival, even when the cost is government dysfunction, a fractured electorate, simmering grievances. When he leaves his leadership position at the end of this year, McConnell, 82, will be ducking out just as the check arrives. Yes, power has a price, and McConnell has ensured that it will be paid not by him, but everyone else. The reviewer, Jennifer Zalai, is a nonfiction book critic for the New York Times. She writes essays and reviews about nonfiction books, often with an eye on how to connect to our current moment. Playing Possum, How Animals Understand Death, by Susanna Manso. This book was also reviewed by Jennifer Zalai. Our neighbor's cat, Mittens, was an adventurer who used to sneak into our house whenever the opportunity presented itself. His other hobbies included daily games of tag with his fellow cats on the block and getting into backyard brawls with raccoons. When he went missing a few weeks ago, our own cat started behaving differently. Usually silent and regal, she became clingy and would wail while she stared at the window. "She's in mourning," my husband said. We assume Mittens was dead. Did our cat assume the same thing? Talking about animals and mourning invites inevitable charges of anthropomorphism, that tempting habit of projecting human characteristics onto a non-human animal. But as Susanna Manso explains in Playing Possum, How Animals Understand Death, our fear of anthropomorphism can lead to the opposite sin of anthropectomy, the denial that an animal exhibits human-like characteristics. Both mistakes are equally serious, Manso writes. They are both false descriptions of reality. Manso is a Spanish philosopher. She translated her book herself. And Playing Possum keeps returning to questions of knowledge. What humans know, what animals know, and what humans may or may not know about what animals may or may not know. Manso stops such lofty conundrums from floating away into the stratosphere by tethering them to intriguing anecdotes from the natural world. A chimpanzee that carries around the corpse of a bush baby, pregnant mice that reabsorb the fetuses into their bodies to avoid the predation of infanticidal males, ants that can be tricked with chemical markers into treating live ants as dead ones. I also learned from this book that playing possum involves more than simply becoming immobile. When an opossum feels threatened, she stops responding to the world and starts to salivate, urinate, defecate, and expel a repugnant-smelling green goo from her anal glands, Manso writes. This seems a lot more involved than just playing. Expelling stinky goo is definitely committing to the bit. Manso compares the imperiled opossum to Schrödinger's cat, dead and alive at the same time. Playing Possum is an unexpected mix of witty and grisly, cerebral and earthy. Manso doesn't so much answer questions about death as raise new ones, encouraging us to shed our reflexive anthropocentrism by paying close attention to what animals do, even when it fails to accord with human modes of behavior. Some animals do appear to experience grief, Manso says, referring to female giraffes wandering about the area where a calf had died, and to peccaries repeatedly grooming a dead peccary's corpse. She opens the book with a striking photograph from a chimpanzee rescue center that went viral in 2009. A dead chimp named Dorothy is being pushed in a wheelbarrow past a group of her fellow chimps, who are uncharacteristically silent while they stare at her, seemingly solemn and transfixed. Were the chimps grieving? Did they know that what had happened to Dorothy would one day happen to them? Manso frames her book in terms of the philosophy of animal minds. She realizes that for skeptical readers who doubt that animals even have minds, such an approach might seem a hard sell. But her enthusiasm for her admittedly morbid subject is so winning that by the end of the book, I was persuaded that many non-human animals do indeed have a concept of death, even if it isn't necessarily the same as our own. Grief indicates an affective bond with the deceased, but Manso cautions that an awareness of actual death need not be a proximate cause. Grief can be caused by the mere absence of a loved one. We tend to conflate grief with an understanding of death because of our emotional anthropocentrism, Manso argues. Given that grief is the prototypical human response to death, we expect animals that understand death to exhibit grief. But this need not necessarily be so. In the same way that there can be grief without a concept of death, there can be a concept of death without grief. Manso points to other responses to death that are more prevalent among non-human animals in the wild, including cannibalism and necrophilia. She says we should consider the role that violence plays in animals' lives. For predators, the death of their prey is a reason for joy. But when we wonder about an animal's understanding of death, we are usually talking about the death of conspecifics, members of an animal's own species, not members of species that an animal has evolved to kill. I don't need a philosopher to tell me that my cat rejoices when she kills a mouse. Death is extremely common in the non-human world. What I had not previously considered was its connection to play. Monson includes a graphic description of the methods that bottlenose dolphins will use to torment and kill harbor porpoises. It's not as if this behavior is a form of predation. The dolphins do not feed on their porpoise victims. Researchers speculate that such seemingly gratuitous harassment gives dolphins a chance to hone their fighting technique and bond with one another. Monson ends her book by highlighting a paradox. Humans have a sophisticated understanding of death, one that includes its inevitability and unpredictability. Yet we are constantly trying to distract ourselves from this terrifying knowledge. Animals in the wild cannot escape this reality, and Monson suggests we might learn something from them. We're not a unique species, she reminds us. We're just another animal. Maybe denying our mortality is our warped version of playing possum. We get so caught up hiding from death that we don't really live. A few words in defense of our country. The biography of Randy Newman by Robert Hilburn. This book was reviewed by Dwight Garner. Randy Newman was a Nepo baby, a sprig of musical royalty. Three of his uncles were Hollywood film composers. One received 45 Oscar nominations and won 9 times. Newman's own father wanted to be a composer. His parents, sensing the family needed to diversify his portfolio, dissuaded him. He became a physician with a celebrity-studded clientele. Those celebrities included Pat Boone, the bland pop singer, who tried to get young Randy signed to the publishing arm of his label. Randy didn't need Boone or anyone else. He was writing songs professionally while still in his teens, and by his early 20s was recognized as an uncommon sort of genius. His first 4 records, released between 1968 and 1974, floored those who knew the real thing when they heard it. His songs were literate, mocking, and dense with the ghosts of American history. His greatness did not go unsung. Rolling Stone named Newman Rock Star of the Year for 1971. The same year Marvin Gaye released What's Going On, Joni Mitchell released Blue, and the Rolling Stones released Sticky Fingers. He broke through to the rest of America 6 years later when his song Short People began blasting from car radios. Here was an anchovy amid pop radio's peaches. Many can remember where they were when they first heard it. No one could recall a hit like it. It was a novelty song with a poison tip. Short People was hilarious. You got to pick 'em up just to say hello. And oh, it was cruel. Short people got no reason to live. It divided people. Some highly cheesed off little people began to pick at his concerts. Newman wrote songs with unreliable narrators. So many listeners gave him the benefit of the doubt about short people. When interviewers asked, "The song's all about prejudice, isn't it?" he would reply, "Yeah." He later commented, "But it wasn't at the beginning. I just thought it was funny, and it was. I wrote it because we needed an up song." Newman made more critically admired albums, but he wouldn't have another major hit until he entered the family business, film music. He wrote and sang You've Got a Friend in Me, the theme song for the Pixar movie Toy Story, one of the highest-grossing films of 1995. He went on to write songs and scores for many other movies. The Pixar work brought him new fans, but baffled old ones. It was like learning that Ambrose Bierce or Lenny Bruce had written a picture book about a bunny. For Newman, To co-opt a line from his mighty song, Louisiana 1927, which has been a beloved standard in New Orleans since Hurricane Katrina hit in 2005, the money rolled all day, the money rolled all night. Newman, 80, is a serious, complicated man who deserves a serious, complicated biography. Robert Hilburn's new book, A Few Words in Defense of Our Country, The Biography of Randy Newman, is not that book. It's a toothless hagiography, packed with obvious filler, notably extended quotations from song lyrics and panegyrics from admirers. Hilburn, who is a longtime pop critic for the Los Angeles Times, has written well-received biographies of Johnny Cash and Paul Simon. But his talents are not in evidence here. This book demonstrates little feel for Newman's music. I wanted it to contain memorable ideas and sentences, but it does not. Newman's mother had family in New Orleans, and he spent a lot of time in that city as a child. This helped give his music a Delta vibe, and his voice its laconic drawl that reminded people of Fats Domino and Ray Charles. Still, his lifelong friend, the music industry titan Lenny Waronker, referred to him as the king of the suburban blues singers. Newman attended high school in Los Angeles and dropped out of UCLA. He was writing songs the entire time. One early song was Mama Told Me Not to Come, which became a hit for Three Dog Night in 1970. It's about feeling uncomfortable at a party. If this book has a theme, it's Newman's lack of comfort in his own body and in America writ large. He was born a bit cross-eyed and was bullied. His shyness blended, as it often will, with misanthropy. He liked to stay inside, reading books and watching television. He was in several car crashes when young and had health problems throughout his life. He felt like an outsider because of his Jewishness. One of his songs, Dixie Flyer, describes what it felt like to arrive in New Orleans with his mother early on and trying to fit in. Asked about assimilation in an interview, he gave an answer that still resonates. That's never been done. There have been thousands of Jewish songwriters, and they have never done it. To be Jewish in America is different. No one wants to be an American more than a Jew. Irving Berlin was more American than John Wayne. But there's a lack of comfort here for Jews, somehow. Is this really our country? And I think sometimes, maybe not. Newman is not presented as an angel. He had a drug period. He left his wife of 16 years for a 21-year-old Cal State student in 1983. But any grit is relentlessly sanded down. Newman's best songs carry out through six or seven emotions in a few stanzas, and they disturb the sediment at the bottom of the American experiment. Sail Away is related in the voice of a slave trader. Rednecks refuse to let the North off the hook for its racism. Political science provides sardonic encouragement to drop the big one now. There is a lot of knockabout humanity and sympathy for the underdog in his work. He's been a consummate and contrary user of the English language. A better reported and more critical biography will probably have to wait until Newman and others central to his story are no longer with us. In the early 1970s, Newman wrote a subversive song for Frank Sinatra about celebrity. Sinatra didn't get the joke, so Newman recorded it himself. Something about the song captured Newman's own ambivalent and awkward embrace of fame. Listen, all you fools out there, go on and love me. I don't care. Oh, it's lonely at the top. The reviewer, Dwight Garner, is a book critic for the New York Times, writing about fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and the book world writ large. Kirtle Creek by Yvonne Battle Felton. This book was reviewed by Gabino Iglesias. The town at the center of Yvonne Battle Felton's new novel, Kirtle Creek, is a small, all-black, separatist community with a strict population policy. One in, one out. To keep the enclave safe, there are many yearly rituals required of residents, including moving on, warding off, the calling, and the running of the widows. Osira has always lived in Kirtle Creek, but she fears her standing because her children broke the town's rules and ran away. Then her father's name is called for a murderous ritual, but rather than submit, he flees. With her position jeopardized, Osira is forced to prove herself by traveling into different realms to answer for Kirtle Creek's sins and make things right, whatever that means. Kirtle Creek explores the sacrifices people are willing to make for safety, and how surrendering freedom for the common good can sometimes morph into self-immolation. Power struggles, pettiness, violence perpetrated in the name of religion, along with dark secrets hidden in the fabric of the community, make life in the small town a repressive, stressful nightmare. With tight dialogue, elegant writing, and a startling ending, this is a wonderful novel about the worst monsters of all, people. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.